Welcome to the Sourcing Hero podcast, produced by UNA, a group purchasing organization that empowers sourcing heroes, and Art of Procurement, the world's largest procurement podcast network. I'm your host, Kelly Barner. The goal of the Sourcing Hero podcast is to capture the epic stories of people who are rising up and beating the odds to create exceptional value within procurement, directly from those heroes themselves. Today, my guest here on the Sourcing Hero podcast is James Meads. James is a career procurement professional turned consultant who recognizes some of the disparities between procurement technology for enterprise-level companies and the digital transformation opportunities and partners that now exist for mid-market companies. So, hi, James. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Kelly. It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So I've already revealed that you've come to the dark side by going from practitioner to consultant, but can you share a little bit more detail about your background and experience for people that haven't previously met you?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you can probably tell from the accent, I'm originally from the UK. Grew up there, went to university there, started my professional career there, and I ended up getting into procurement because, like most people, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I came out of university, when I finished my studies. And you know, I'm from a blue collar family. My parents didn't really have much sort of career advice in that sense to give me. So when I came back after I did a languages degree. So I spent my third year abroad in Germany. And when I got back, I had to go and find a summer job to pay myself through or help pay myself through the fourth year of my final year of university, and I stumbled upon a position with a local automotive supplier that needed some support in their buying department over the summer because they just won a major new contract with a big OEM. And I didn't know what purchasing was, didn't know what buying was, but I did it just grateful of the fact that I didn't have to go and work night shift in a factory packing boxes or doing something like that. And I really enjoyed it, actually. It was something that was completely new to me. I'd always been pretty good with things like Word and Excel and sort of office technology. So, yeah, I quite enjoyed it. And that opened my eyes and thought, well, you know, maybe that's something when I finish that I'd quite like to pursue a career in. And sort of fast forward 2.5 years later, after doing a couple of jobs in between and doing a bit of work and travel, I applied to go on the graduate training scheme with Jaguar Land Rover. And that's ultimately where I started my career in procurement.
Now, speaking of opening eyes, I believe it was in 2018 that you made the decision to leave the corporate world and strike out on your own. So you were ahead of the trend that's now being referred to as the Great Recession, sort of in the wake of the pandemic, with everybody saying, this is not how I want to spend the rest of my working life. I'm interested in your thoughts about that transition, both in terms of making the decision to sort of take the leap and also what you ultimately learned. Is there anything that you would like to share about that decision or advice that you would offer up to others that are currently considering the same thing?
Advice would certainly be make sure that you've got some savings because you never know what's around the corner. That's certainly something that struck me. I mean, I left the corporate world in 2018 and then spent most of 2019 working, doing a freelance gig part-time for my previous employer while I was trying to build a website that was completely irrelevant to what I'm doing now, actually. It was another sort of niche that I was going down at the time. But then obviously coming out of that gig, when was it, November 2019, you know, and 3 months later, COVID hit. So, you know, joking aside, I'm very, very grateful that I had some savings to see myself through 2020. The other thing is, I think, is, well, what's your why? What's your driver? Because the big thing that pushed me to leave ultimately was I had a colleague who will remain nameless, but he was really, really negative, hated his job, was only really there because he'd been with the company a long time and wanted to make sure that he got the full pension when he left and still had a couple of kids in their early 20s that he was paying through college. And I just didn't want to be him in sort of 10, 15 years time, being that sort of bitter, grumpy, older colleague that is very negative and hates on the company all the time. And I just thought, well, I don't have a big mortgage. I don't have children to pay through university. I don't have a lot of the pull factors that keep people in their jobs that they don't really enjoy. And I thought, well, what have I really got to lose? And one of the big things was, for me, I wanted location independence. I hate the winter. I always wanted to, especially growing up in the UK, you know, I just, when the sun comes out in January, it's like a novelty. So that was really what drove me to do it. It was like, well, what really do I have to lose? And, you know, there's always the opportunity to go back in if it doesn't work out. That was really sort of what the pull and the push factors, I guess.
I love your point about why. Right, because so many times, and this is a plunge that I've taken, obviously Philip Eidson at Art of Procurement has done the same thing. So there are a lot of us that have kind of gone on this journey. But you do have to be prepared, and you have to be prepared with enough funds to have stability, and you have to be prepared for, an emotional toll or psychological toll. But I think that why, having a real drive, mine, sort of your equivalent to being location independent and not wanting to turn into a grumpy old man, my driver in the very beginning was absolutely despising the confinement of a cube. And so for me, that was kind of enough to say, okay, you know what? If I don't want to be in a cube, then I need to go and sort of blaze my own trail and work from the kitchen table for a while. But I think you have to have that why to fall back on as things get difficult or as uncertainty arises. So I think that's a great piece of advice. But I would like to get your perspective on sort of our main topic. And this is a particularly interesting one given where procurement technology is on its current evolution. And that's this idea that there's a difference between enterprise-intended procurement technology, and then more mid-market or even smaller company technology that's available. And you had made the point when we previously spoke that most procurement technology is marketed at enterprise-level clients. Why do you think that's sort of the current state of things?
Yeah, it's a great question. And obviously, I'm not a marketing guy for a procurement tech company, so I can't answer this conclusively.
Thank goodness for that, James.
But I mean, I think part of it is this whole, you know, hottest girl in high school principle, that they're all chasing after the same clients, but and they've perhaps not really given thought to, well, at some point, especially now with this drive towards sustainability and ESG, all of these mid-market businesses are going to have to do something as well, because their customers are going to demand it from them. And while you know, enterprise level procurement tech was probably driven by the need to be more efficient in things like P2P and sourcing, I think a lot of the mid-market drive, yes, that will be a part of it, but I think a lot of it will come from the fact that just legally and ethically, they're going to be pushed to do a lot more on sustainability and on, especially in North America, on things like diversity. Mm. And there just isn't, I mean, there are the tools out there, there are the solutions out there, but they certainly don't seem to get as much airtime. And there don't seem to be as many of them chasing this market. And when you think about it from a logical perspective, there are only, the clue's in the name, right? There are only 500 Fortune 500 companies. Right. And if all 500 of them say, no, I'm not interested in your software, then where do you go if that's been your sort of sales and marketing strategy? So I do think it is a little bit of a fool's garden that some of these tech companies are going down, being sort of hell-bent on chasing after enterprise-level clients, unless what they've developed is essentially an add-on or a plug-in that fits in with something like a Reba or Cooper, and then I can kind of get it. But if it's a standalone solution, it does seem to be perhaps a bit of a risky strategy to go down, or maybe even not the most prudent strategy when you think the mid-market is so much bigger. And yes, there will be a little bit of educating to do, especially when you get down to the smaller end of that market, you know, the 10, $20 million dollar or euro companies that, you know, may only have one or two procurement people. But the opportunity and the sheer range, I mean, it would be, you can almost carve out an industry sector and say, you know, I'm going to be the P2P solution for green tech companies, or I'm going to be the e-sourcing solution for a heavy industry. It just gives you that many more options to go after.
Well, I'm wondering, based on your point of view, if there isn't sort of a two-way opportunity here, right? Because mid-sized companies may be looking at these sort of large enterprise intended technology solutions and saying, you know, that doesn't quite fit. But then there's been an explosion in new procurement technology startups, and enough of them have been around for long enough that I don't even know you would necessarily consider them startups anymore. They're truly stable. They have an established brand and reputation and value proposition. Does it sort of work both ways, that these mid-market companies that aren't quite the right fit for enterprise procurement technology, and then some of these newer procurement companies that have been around for a while, is there a match that's not quite being made there because they're just sort of looking past each other?
Yeah, I think that is the case. I think some of these new startups that are coming on board are maybe perhaps definitely going after the wrong market. And if they maybe trim down the features or even sort of trim down their ambitions in terms of their marketing budget and just went after getting clients and becoming profitable a little bit earlier, I think that would give them the opportunity then to scale and carve out a niche in the mid-market. And if you look at their price point, you know, a lot of these solutions, you know, they're not charging the same as some of the big enterprise level suites. So if you can get a pretty decent P2P platform or e-sourcing suite or contract management software for a fairly modest five-figure sum per year for your, you know, mid-market business that's turning over, let's say, $100-200 million or euro, that's a pretty powerful piece of tech in terms of cost versus benefit ratio that you're looking at there. Because even if it just saves the equivalent workload of one head in your team, you know, even if you retain that head and put them onto doing something else, it's a massive payback. You know, this technology, when applied right, will pay back in weeks and months rather than years. And the other thing is, it doesn't take an army of consultants and years worth of planning to be able to implement it as well. You know, most of these, being best of breed and cloud based, are pretty much plug and play. I mean, some of them do claim, you know, digitize in a day. And I do think that is a little bit spurious. I don't think that's, you know, 100% true, but certainly within a couple of weeks, you can get these things up and running and effectively working. Whereas if you're implementing a suite, you know, good luck doing that in less than probably a quarter. And that's after you've done the year of planning ahead of that to get all of your ducks in a row and get all of the IT resources necessary to be able to do it.
Now, a minute ago when we were talking about the different sized procurement organizations, you sort of in passing brought up this idea of how many people work on the procurement team. And I'm wondering if there's a factoring of how big is the procurement team versus how big is the company, you know, especially if you're looking at implementing something that's going to significantly change the way the team works. You might be looking at involving sort of a parallel consulting engagement to do some process change or, you know, some restructuring in alignment with implementing the technology so that you get that ROI. How should companies that are in that mid-market space look at the connection between the number of people that are or should be ultimately on the procurement team versus just the size of the company or the size of the overall spend?
I would look at it slightly differently, and I would take the typical salary of, let's say a procurement category manager, for argument's sake, and I would take that salary, I would divide it by 225 working days. I'm European. We have 6 weeks holiday here. Sorry, North Americans. And then I would divide it by, let's say, 8 hours a day. And I would work out what is that person's effective hourly rate. Okay. So if you can do it easily. Take any number of salary. Let's not argue whether it's gross or net or with social contributions or not. Let's just take a round number. And then work out what that person's effective hourly rate is. Now, we all know, you've worked in procurement, Kelly. I know Phil has as well. if the typical category manager is spending 50% of their time doing administrative tasks or repetitive tasks or non-strategic activity, that you could theoretically, you know, hire someone off a freelancer platform in a low-cost country to do that at a fraction of the cost, then I would look at it really of, well, how much more could that procurement person deliver over and above the savings and the value that they're delivering currently to the business if their hands were freed of doing all of this busy work? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are three ways to do that. You can get rid of it if it's a pointless piece of bureaucracy, like, you know, having to get sign off for travel requests. It's a stupid policy. Trust your employees to spend their travel budget. They know when they need to travel somewhere. There's a way that you can delegate it. You can hire more junior level staff, admin assistants, to do a lot of the work that category managers are doing. Sales still have them. Funny that. Or you can automate it through procurement technology. But through whichever of these means, you need to make sure, however big your procurement team is, I think big corporates are the biggest culprits of doing this, of just wasting people's time on activity that could be done by technology or more junior level staff, or is just a process that doesn't need to be there because somebody that needs to keep their job is justifying why it's there. So I would just use that example of how do you best deploy procurement resources.
Now, when it comes to these organizations learning from each other, you know, I think it's human nature. We all have a tendency to look at people and organizations that we consider to be very successful. And those people and organizations tend to be bigger, better known, right, have a larger presence. Is it a mistake for heads of procurement at mid-market companies to look up at the Fortune 500 and say, okay, I want to do everything just like them versus doing what's best for my situation? Sort of like it's potentially an issue for those same mid-market procurement technology providers to look up at the huge enterprise suites and saying, okay, I want to be where they are someday, and so I'm going to do everything to the best of my ability now, the way they're doing it now, versus doing the best that I can with what I have. Should there be more of an effort, both on the tech side and the practitioner side, for people to connect, in addition to looking up, connect with people that are sort of at the same point in their journey or the same size or maturity of organization? Is there an opportunity there?
I think certainly there's a huge advantage for the tech companies, for the procurement software companies, to work with mid-market or smaller businesses if they're still in the phase of honing and developing and adding features to their product, because the policies that those companies have in place, or they may not even have them, around, you know, how you engage with, you know, working with external suppliers and sharing data, you're not going to have to go through the same, you know, legal and internal audit process that big corporations have to go through. So if you're a startup that's at sort of minimum viable product MVP and you want to get some case studies and some clients using your software, I would tentatively say you're going to be a lot faster being able to do that by approaching the mid-market, because they're just leaner and more agile in terms of being able to get internal approval to do that and potentially share confidential data. I think do mid-market companies sometimes look up to corporates and sort of look to mirror them in terms of what they're doing? I mean, yeah, I think they do, Kelly, but I think it's a foolish decision to do that, because I truly believe that the new advantage of our generation now is being small. And you can look at that. If I just take an example from geopolitics, if you look at Estonia, you know, the startup nation, it's a nation of, I think, 1.5 million people. They've got more unicorns per capita than any other country in the world. They've put pretty much all of their government administration online. They've simplified their tax system to have like flat taxation and cut their tax code. Whereas you look at somewhere like the US or the UK or France and Germany, it's like night and day. And I think you can mirror that in the business world and say, there are more advantages now of being small because you can just move faster and a lot more agile than some of these big legacy companies can. I mean, there are exceptions. If you look at some of the tech companies, you know, Apple and Google and Amazon are really well known for being innovative and partnering with startups and pushing forward. But in more traditional industries. You know, you look at automotive or consumer goods or, you know, any of the old economy, mm-hmm. and they're way behind.
Well, and to your point about agility, I mean, if we want to get a better idea on the advantages of being small and lean and agile, we really don't have to look any further than some of the smaller suppliers that any size corporate is working with, right? Because there are almost cries for help from the supplier population. They're saying, look, you sought me out, you recruited me because I was small and innovative and I could do things quickly and respond to your feedback and we could build a relationship, but then you're making me go through this legal process or these payment delays that are crushing my operation, you know, and yet they can deliver value for us in some ways that much larger companies often can't, right? And so I think your point about Estonia is a great example. And sure, there are companies that have sort of defied the drag of becoming big. One of my favorite business books of all time is The End of Competitive Advantage, by a woman named Rita Gunther McGrath. And she writes about just that, sort of when you get too big to fail is when you become too big to succeed, because you naturally have to build walls and very stiff structures to sort of prop things up. And it becomes very challenging to respond to opportunities or challenges, frankly. So I think that's an excellent point. And I have a feeling people are going to be looking up Estonia to learn a little bit more about that country if they don't already know much about that part of the world.
Well, that book that you mentioned, Kelly, I'll have to put that on my Audible list, I think.
Definitely put that on your list. That is a fantastic read. So as we start to wind down our time, James, I want to ask you the question that I put in front of everybody that joins me here on The Sourcing Hero. And that is, what does the idea of a sourcing hero, or maybe more broadly, what does the notion of heroism mean in a business context from your perspective and based on your experience?
I think especially now it's particularly apt. I think the sourcing hero now, or heroism, is embodied by resilience in procurement teams these days, because if you look at all of the supply chain crises that we're having to deal with, there's an increasing deluge of governance that's going to come now around things like diversity and sustainability. And I'm not trying to say it's not important by any stretch of the imagination, but if companies are just recruiting chiefs to put policies in place, but they aren't recruiting any Indians to actually go out and implement them, and expecting all of this additional workload to be dumped onto category managers, then, you know, they're going to be fighting on all battlefronts if that's coming their way. So I think resilience and just the ability to keep going, that often they're not recognized for all of the hard work that they do. But I really think that, especially more so now going into the future, that procurement will become increasingly, you know, the backbone of the business when it comes to understanding what's out there in the supply chain.
Well, and I think in particular, your point about, I wrote this down, deluge of governance. What a fantastic phrase. I mean, I can almost visualizing like a tsunami, right? And you can see where that would be a natural response to saying, oh, we've had so much unpredictability, we need more structures, right? But that's going to drive out any agility that we might have had based on the skills and knowledge and experience of our people, of our partnerships with third parties. And so I have a feeling, James, that you are on point about that. Now, if folks that are listening in would like to reach out and get in touch with you to connect about your opinions or any other work that you're doing, where is the best place to send them?
The easiest place to find me and where I'm the most active is LinkedIn. My last name is spelled M-E-A-D-S. And if you reach out to me on LinkedIn and just explain where you came across me, I would be really, really happy to connect. The other thing that we'll be launching, I'm not sure when this goes out, is the what I alluded to around procurement technology for mid-market businesses. So I'm also in the process now of developing and will be launching a website that sort of assists with that, which is called procurementsoftware.site, which should be live towards the end of February.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sourcing Hero podcast. Join us again next time for more true stories of sourcing and business heroism performed by your colleagues and peers. Look for The Sourcing Hero wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe. Finally, don't forget, Sourcing heroism is taking place all around us, every day. Keep your eyes open and you're bound to see it. Until next time, I'm your host, Kelly Barner. Stay well, and always remember that you can be a hero too.